Good morning, everybody. Lovely to see you. The first thing we're going to do before we do anything else, doesn't matter if you haven't got Siddurim, because you can rely on the principle which I've often shared, is Shomer Ka'aneh, just listening to me as if you've said the prayer, or by all means joining with me. Obviously, with the situation with Iran, what's happening around the world, particularly in Israel, people still having to run to shelters, and the situation, it's obviously appropriate for us to say Psalm 121 together, pray for everybody's well-being and pray for peace, pray for God's protection. So please feel free to join me or simply to listen to me as we sing as follows. Shilam ha'alos esa'enai el ha'horim me'ayin yavo ezri ezri me'im adonai ose shomayim va'oret. Al yitain la mot raglecha, al yanum shomerecha, hine lo yanum velo yishan, shomer Yisrael, Adonai shomerecha, Adonai tzilcha, al yad yeminecha, yomam hashemesh lo yakecha, ve'yareach, Balayla Adonai Yishmarecha Mikol Ra Yishmah Es Nafshecha Adonai Yishmar Tseischa Uvoecha Beata Ve'adolam.
Simpsons, yeah. Some of it, a picture of a missile that was dropped on Yerushalayim a mile from her. That was the building where Rabbi Rabinowitz and Dalia live.
Oh my goodness me.
Remember
from Edgeware.
When was this? Just
a few days ago.
Yeah. So very much everyone's in our prayers. And So we wish them all well and we pray for them all. Now, I was just shown this. So here's the dilemma. I have no doubt, particularly when very well-intentioned, lovely people who have access to these bring them to the synagogue and say it's a gift, and I'm sure they mean it with a good heart. So obviously, the last thing we want to do is offend them. But I don't know whether you know the origin of this. This came from, I'm not saying necessarily it's the agenda now, but the organisation that publishes these used to publish a second volume with them as well, called in Hebrew the Brit Hadasha, which means the New Testament. And the original purpose of giving these to Jews was to build up good relationships with them to then start throwing in Yoshki and how really we should be going in that direction. I'm not for one second suggesting that everybody who does this today, but that is the origin. And therefore, it might feel strange, but where if you would, this particular edition, the best thing you do, if you know somebody non-Jewish who can benefit from it, that is the best thing to do. I must tell you, I'm not saying I would necessarily do this, but I understand why he did it. Some years ago, at one of the synagogues in Israel, a whole box full of these arrived. And when the rabbi at that stage opened them, he tore them all up. Ooh. Right? And the reason why he did that, although it feels, because it has God's name, but because the agenda, I'm not saying that's the agenda of the people that give them to you today, but the original organisation that published them and still is going, that was its intention and that's why he did it. So I'm not saying necessarily you have to go as far as that, but it's best, if possible, without offending anybody, they don't need to know that, you know, because you still want to appreciate that they're doing it with the best of intentions, but if you want to give it to the charity shop or to the local church or whatever, that it is appropriate to do that. I'll put it in those terms, yeah, okay? But I'm no doubt the intentions were good from the people that were giving them. And, yeah.
Did you see what they wrote on the other side?
What is it?
Well, the other side, so yes, society for distribution. Yeah, you see, this society, they were distributing Hebrew scriptures, not for you to improve your Jewish.
About Pesach, yeah.
As Pesach drawing near, we would like to present you with this beautiful edition of the Torah. Now, I'm sure, because that's the purpose of it, the gesture, that's why the last thing we would do in a million years is say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to take it. So you should take it to show that you appreciate that they're doing it with a good heart and what have you. But, and we will be blessed in the reading of this
message then.
Sorry?
Does that give a mixed message then?
Well,
it encourages them to come back again and give you the...
Let me put it this way. What I would say, you're right, Lindy. What I would say is, if it's not going to, it's a typical difficult one because you don't want to offend well-meaning people, right? What you could say is obviously I have one. Thank you very. It's most kind. Yeah. Please, therefore, rather than take that, find a nice way to basically not. If you can, that's definitely the best thing to do. Well, it's that balance, but yeah, that's a balance between not offending, because I've got no doubt that the people are not necessarily doing it to evangelize. Well, maybe they are. Maybe they are. I don't know. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They're not. They're doing it as a genuine act. Particularly, maybe it will be with what's going on in the world. They're showing sympathy and kindness, and Passover's coming up and what have you. So the last thing you want to do is offend, and I think that's a very good way to say, oh, that's so kind, I've got one, but if you can give it to somebody else, the only thing is they might give it to another Jewish person, that's the only thing. It's, but at least from your point of view, you know, you understand. Yeah, you're quite right. Technically, that is the thing to do with that, but we don't want to cause offence. You're right, it's getting that balance. Say again? It's from an organiser. I mean, they've probably, the people who received them in various churches and what have you, probably don't realise that this was the original agenda of how this whole thing got set up, right? So, and they get job lots of them sent and give these to your Jewish, you know. Now, it's a tricky one. I'll tell you where it gets particularly tricky, because some of the best friends of Israel are Christian Zionists, right? Yeah. Right. And there was this whole thing about when they started to get more involved with certain synagogues in Leeds, should we work with them, should we not work with them? So the overall view was, and it's a similar idea, we don't want to offend, and any friend of Israel, we can't afford, particularly in the current climate, not to. But if there's an added agenda that they're trying to take you down the path of Yoshki, then that is a problem. You've got to know the boundaries. And of course, this is about scripture and about belief and about theology, as if it's the same scriptures. And the words might be the same, but the intention behind why... I'm not saying that's the intention of the person who gave it to you or whatever. It's a tricky one. So you don't want to affect, particularly at the moment, at the same time, the agenda of why these were put together is not a good idea to have them in on our bookshelves, you know? So therefore, it's a tricky one. But I would say the best thing to do is to say, oh, that's very kind, thank you very much. Please feel free to give them to somebody else who can benefit from it, yeah? Or it may even be a good idea to say, a non-Jew, because we Jews have this book for those who have... I mean, the whole purpose is to distribute these to the Jews. Why do you think that is? Yeah, that's the point. That's the idea. But I'm sure it's done with a good heart, so you've got to balance that up. Anyways, yes. So she can either give it to the charity shop... Give it to the challenge. Look, hardliners, I must tell you, like Rob would say, destroy it. Hardliners would say, you know, it's to take on the show, destroy it. If you feel you just can't do that because it's Hebrew, and I just can't. But so just don't have it in your position without offending anybody who means well. Yeah, yeah. No, it's in Hebrew. No, it's not Seamus. It's definitely not Seamus. That, by all accounts, in fact, there's a famous. But people think because it's not, because it wasn't done for the purpose of Shabbos morning learning. It's done. Yeah. The whole purpose of this being published is to encourage Jews to be more aware of how the Christian message. That was the reason why these were published. Not Seamus. Definitely not Seamus.
My dad had one.
No, definitely not Seamus. Definitely, that's. Definitely. There's a famous story. No, I understand why. And to be honest with you, before I knew the halacha, and so, because when I saw this, this was long before I was around, when I saw this, I was horrified on all levels, right? So he told a famous story which somebody corroborated, because the late chief rabbi from years ago, Rabbi Dr. Hertz, right? So Rabbi Dr. Hertz was very. Not only learned as a great rabbi, but very great learned in non-Jewish biblical scholarship. One of the reasons why then his particular chumash was so popular, aside from the gems, he was very good at quoting non-Jewish sources, right? So the story goes that when one of these was given to him, they thought, well, he'd appreciate it, right? A Jewish person gave it to him, and he said, where are you going to put it? He says, sometimes my chair is a bit low, I'm going to put it under my seat. So, and the guy was horrified, right? Rabbi Hertz, of all people, with good. And he explained, you've got to understand why these were published. They were not published as a holy thing. They were published by Christians. We're not short of our own publishing houses making chumash. So if we just look at it logically, why didn't Jews need their own book from Christians? Let's just look at the logic here, right? Okay. Because there's a second volume which at some point they may want to share. Well, you've got number one, you might as well get the next. That's what's the whole purpose of it, you see. But in today's world, Do you want us to, oh, this Jew I was prepared to get. And it may be that the person has no idea. They just think it's a nice thing and it's coming from, that's why you've got to get the balance. Okay.
No, they can interact.
Well, of course. What can I say? But, you know, we're in, yeah. You've got to get the balance. Yeah, exactly. As in missionaries, exactly right. I want to dedicate this year this morning. Deborah's got your site today for a dear late mum. And the Hebrew name is?
Etel Bas Mordechai.
Etel Bas Mordechai. I know Graham's got a yacht site tonight, hasn't he? And give him my apologies, I'm going to go to Leeds to see my mum. Not quite, I want to go to see him. What I mean is that I can't be here for the davening, but give him my love and best wishes. And I will put another message on for the fellas to support the minion. So where are we? Yes, we've got for Irene Bassio, safe. And then Jill, solid. I see you've got yacht site. Where's Jill? There you go. Yeah, you've got yacht site for your mum, haven't you, coming up? Chana Bassaev. Then Tina's got yacht site coming up for her dear late mother Zara. Sora Esther Bastsvi, we dedicate for Inishon as well. Any other yacht sites coming up anybody wants me to mention? Yes, Jackie.
My mother.
Of course, I can see it here. I'm so sorry, Esther. Your mother, Esther Brian Abbas Moshe. Yeah, wish you long life. Any other dedications to make? Okay, lovely. Now, so Mel very kindly says to me, Rabbi, what should I put out? Should I put out Chumash? So I said, listen, you are the convener and initiator. What would you like? She said, well, the Haggadah went down, and it is our last one before Pesach. And it also allows me to fill in the bits that I didn't get a chance to say the other day. And for those who didn't have a chance to join us last Wednesday, so there's a little bit of backtracking in order to take us forward. So if you remember, we started at the very beginning, a very good place to start, as the song goes, with page 4. And we're all using the same edition, so that's good. So we don't need to worry about this edition, that edition, page 4. And I mentioned about some have the custom to sing through the order of the Seder. And I gave a couple ideas for tunes, and it reminded me I've got to make a recording for those who want the recordings for a tune. Right. What I didn't mention then, so even for those who were there, because I've heard him say this before, it looked like I was just simply saying, oh, we're mapping out the order of the Seder before we do the Seder. Okay, this, in other words, where are we going tonight? What's step one, step two, step three? What I didn't draw attention to, and actually this particular Haggadah, no disrespect to it, has made a mistake. Has made a mistake, because if you look at page 4, you would assume how many steps are there to the Pesach Seder. 14, there are not 14 steps. It's very important, they're not 14. What it's done is it's put two steps together as if they are one. They're actually two. And you'll see, through the course of my share, it is very important to get the correct number of steps. And there are not 14. And I could give you what the correct number is now, but hey, let's build it up, you know, the typical Rabbi Kleiman fashion, so it all comes together. Aha, right, okay. So rather than tell you, so where have they made the mistake? Are they missing? No, it's just they've put two together, right? I'm not at the moment going to tell you which one they've put two together, but just bear in mind, there are not 14 steps. The number is different. We will get there. But what I then want to do, because we actually got as far as the four questions last Wednesday, which, and if you remember, we all know the four questions. Why on this night? The only type of bread you're allowed to have, as we all know, is unleavened. On all the nights, I could have leavened or unleavened. Tonight, it's got to be unleavened. Is an answer given at this stage? No. Okay. Even when later, we mentioned this on Wednesday, we are given an answer as to why we eat matzah, but not why we can't have chametz. The actual question is, normally I can have either. Tonight I can only have unleavened. I can't have leavened bread, okay? Do we get an answer to that particular question? No, but later on we get a question as to why we specifically eat matzah. And of course the definition for the matzah is different from the one we said at the beginning of the Seder. Because how did we describe the matzah at the beginning of the Seder when I spoke on Wednesday about ha lachma anua? We say at the beginning of the Seder, this is the bread of affliction, bread of poverty. Okay, that's why we're eating it. And yet later we say, no, this is because they didn't have time for their dough to rise and we had to leave quickly. Which is it? When did it change? We'll get there, and if we don't, you'll remind me, Rabbi, answer that question, please. Okay, anyway, so you've got the four questions. Why the only type of bread we're allowed to have is unleavened? Why have we got to have bitter herbs? Why do we dip twice? Why the reclining? And so, the notice, so we're now on page 9, we've just had those four questions, and we're supposed to now get the answer, it says here. So if I want to know the answer, I'm expecting in this following bit of text an answer to the question, why am I must I only have unleavened bread. I can't have normal bread. Why have I got to have bitter herbs? Why dipping twice? And why reclining? Because it's the answer. Well, let's see if we get the answer. You probably tell by my... It's on page... Oh, you got, so you got two versions of the same... Oh, right. So, because the one I'm looking at says page 9, says the answer. Is it page 8 on yours? Yeah, interesting. Okay. Right, so in the one I'm using, it's either page 8 or 9 or thereabouts. You'll see it says the answer, okay? Before we get to the answer, have you noticed on Saturday night, it's a bit like the Hokey Cokey. In, out, in, right, so sometimes the matzah's out, sometimes it's in. Have you noticed sometimes you've got to cover it? It'll say, cover the matzah. Uncover the matzah. What's that all about? In, what's, why, sometimes I cover it, sometimes I don't. Right, okay? So, before we give the answer, have you all got the stage instruction? Uncover the matzah. Can you all see that?
Yes.
What difference does it make whether I uncover the matzah or cover the matzah in terms of what matzah is supposed to be there for? I'll come to it, don't worry. I'm making a in my head. So here's the answer. Here, are you ready for the answer? I'm expecting the answer to four questions. Why can I only have matzah and not normal bread as well, or instead of, whatever? Why bitter herbs? Why dipping twice? Why leaning? Here's the answer. We were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt. And God brought us out from there. Biyad chazaka, with a strong hand. My wife likes to get all dramatic. Strong hand? With a strong hand of his own and an outstretched arm. Great. Does that answer the question why I can't have normal bread? Why I've got to have bitter herbs? Why I dip twice and why I recline? No, it just says God brought us out of Egypt. So now I would expect the Haggadah to then go into that, go into the detail, and then link that detail as to how I relate to these ideas by only having matzah, by having bitter herbs, by dipping twice, and by reclining. Oh no, now it goes off a complete tangent. Having given you the headline, well, God brought us out of Egypt with a strong hand in that. Now what? And then he goes, now what would have happened had he not done that? All of a sudden the Haggadah goes, why do I need, but he did do that. Well, what would have happened had he not done that? And that's what the Haggadah does. It says, now if God hadn't brought us out of Egypt, then we, our children, our children might still have been enslaved to Pharaoh in Egypt. Now, my grandmother used to have this wonderful expression, if the Bobby was a Zaidi. In other words, you can always say, it might have been like this, it might have been like that. Why? What's the point of this theoretical? Had he not done it? He did do it. And even if he hadn't done it, is it likely that world developments would be that we would still be schlepping wheelbarrows in Egypt? You know, I don't think so, you know? So again, it's a strange thing to say. Now, had he not brought us out of Egypt, which he did, but let's contemplate if he hadn't, then we would still be slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, says the Haggadah, right? And because of that, So even if we're super from and knowledgeable and wise, kulanu nevonim, and all people of understanding, kulanu zakenim, and even if we're, and zakenim here means the idea that you are experienced and advanced in years and very wise and learned, kulanu yodim hatzeh Torah, and even if we all are well versed in the Torah, we know the Torah, mitzvah alein lesaper b'tziyatz Mitzrayim, would still be our duty to tell the story of the departure from Egypt. In other words, nobody's exempt. Okay? I remember, I won't say where, many years ago I was in a certain community where we used to do a communal seder. And unlike the lovely ladies of Pinner, who obviously come on a Monday because they want to learn, they want to know more, right? But I get it. Seder night can be late. Seder night, there's a lot to do. People are hungry. I get it. If I haven't got time, because I want to make sure I cover all the material, to tell you the wonderful wisdom that a great teacher of mine, Rabbi Nissan David Dubov, I don't know if any of you know him, it's phenomenal, right? So, I'm nearly giving away where I was. Anyway, so he was in the part of the world, near, not too far, where I was going to this particular community. And they had a communal Seder, and I think the earliest that year you could have made Kiddush and started Seder was something like 8:35. And they wanted to start at 7:45. And me being impetuous, because it's hard for you to realise when you see this mature, patient, measured rabbi that he's even... I wasn't always like this, one learns, you know. So I'm coming, what do you mean? You can't start the Seder before 8:30. And this is an Orthodox shul. Whatever people do, that's their own business. We're doing a communal Seder. Like when you come to shul, we've got to make sure everything's, you know, just so, you know, because it's a public place of Jewish observance, right? So I remember sitting with Rabbi Dovim and saying, what do you think? I can't stop for 8:35. He said, if you carry on like that, you'll last 2 minutes, he said to me. I said, right? He said, you'll last 2 minutes, right? So he brought out, I wish I still had it. See, I'm a hoarder, I don't know where this is. He brought out a song about the Seder to the tune of the Hokey Cokey, right? And it had 15 verses.
Yeah,
oh, right. And it says something like, and it says, you get the chroses in, out, you know, da, 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 da. And I'm thinking, what he was saying to me is like this. You can either go in all guns blazing, saying you can't start before 8:35. Or, right, my riv's at 7:45. It doesn't have to be the quickest my riv in the world. Right, okay. You go, right. You get everybody sat down by a 9:45. You give an introduction. You say, this is what we're going to do. And then you bring out this song. And if you don't sing it too quickly, by the time you've finished, it'll be 8:35. Now, that's seichel, right? Okay. Now, why am I telling you this? Because there were times during that particular Seder, and I know you might find this hard to believe, because I can tell you enjoy it after, were certain people saying, get on with it already. We know. We do it every year. There were the odd mutterings like that. We know. But what does this part? I don't care whether you know, it says, whether you are cool and you can be the wisest of the wisest of the most. This is what it says. No matter how learned you are, there are always new things to learn on Seder, and you've got to go over what you think you already know. That, right? And the key point it's making in the way that they rises is that this defines who we are as Jews. Seder night defines who we are as Jews. Had we not had Seder night, we would have been lost to history. Right? So you don't need to literally think, oh, we'd still be... What it means is that before we came out of Egypt, we'd nearly got to a point where had we not been brought out then, there'd have been no Jewish people to be brought out. Because everything had become so diluted. There are certain things, I think we've shared it before, we'd kept our Jewish names, we kept our mode of dress, okay? We were discreet about, you know, we didn't shop each other publicly, various things, but there was a lot we didn't do and didn't know and had forgotten about what we'd been learning from Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, okay? And the point it's making is, had the importance of this event not been preserved through the Jihad, God not brought us out at that moment, there'd have been no Jewish people to bring out. And you've got to understand your responsibility of continuity. Your responsibility is continuity. No matter how much you think you know, no matter how from you are, no matter how learned you are, you have to have this sacred duty to appreciate what the Exodus is all about, and it's more than just coming out of Egypt. The coming out of Egypt is the sort of centre around which everything works, and therefore you have to talk about it, but it's not the overall goal, it's the means to get to the goal. Very important, and this will explain a lot of things about Seder night, because you could say, well, if the whole point is about the coming out of Egypt, how come there's so much that we talk about which has got absolutely nothing to do with the coming out of Egypt? And you'll see what I mean shortly, okay? So of course we talk about it, but if you look at the overall structure of the God, we don't talk about it that much in the script. There's really only one paragraph, and we're going to get to that paragraph, that deals with the story of in Egypt and the coming out of Egypt. But the rest of it is things like, now what would have happened had God not brought us out of Egypt? And then, having not told the story, we're about to speak about five rabbis who spent the whole night telling the story that we've not told. That's exactly what's going to happen. So we've just said, now we've understood why it's so important to tell this story. But the emphasis seems to be more on how you approach the story and study the story rather than the story itself. It's rather strange if you look at the structure of the Haggadah. If you were to look at the Haggadah as, right, a bit like a machzor. So you go to shul, it's machzor, you know, I say that prayer, that you've done your duty. But as I mentioned at your lunch the other day, simply going, you know, Ma'aseh, Rabbi, would you do that page? Rabbi, I've done that page, okay, that's achieving nothing. Nothing. Because you've got to understand the messages of the Haggadah and what the Haggadah is saying to you. Now, if you want to do it in Hebrew and in English, brilliant. If your Hebrew is your mother tongue, great. Right? I've got to tell you, am I right? It's not my mother tongue. I can speak it, right? But I don't think in it, okay? And therefore, when you get to the answer, it's about dealing with questions and understanding and engaging with the messages of say tonight. And a key principle, which really everything I'm going to say today hopefully is going to display this, is Rav Soloveitchik, great rabbi of the last century, of leader American Jewry and world Jewry for that matter, said, the purpose of Seder tonight is not to narrate the story, but to study the story. And he says, what's the difference between narration and study? Narration is simply telling a story. But you, when you study a story, you're looking at what lessons, messages, morals, lessons do we take from this story? A historian who writes a good history is bringing out those things which are timeless. There are the examples of them in a particular time. And my goodness me, are we living through that now, right? When, how do you deal with tyrants? Do you try diplomacy or do you have to show might? Old story, we're living through it now. What is the? How do we stop persecution? How do we, in other words, we take the issues and bring them into the now. It's not, but that's what they did then. Okay, they came out, we've all come out of Egypt, everybody happy, great. What does that mean? Particularly when we get to the crescendo part later on, which says, each and every one of you has to personally feel as if you have just come out of Egypt. Now, isn't that a bit of a stretch? I mean, so I've got to think that 2 minutes, I've got to imagine somebody's whipping my back and making me schlep wheelbarrows, and now I've got to feel, that is not your reality. It's not my, is that what it means? Of course that's not what it means. But we take the story of our people and the key turning point in our history and see what lessons it teaches us throughout history. And that's really what the God is saying, is that if you just see this as something that happened way back then, right, you know, you've got to understand that had the Exodus not happened, we wouldn't be here today. There'd be no Judaism. And the impact of why we are here and what we've got to do and what that Exodus was for, and it was more than just coming out of Egypt. That was the core event that had to happen for our purpose. What are we supposed to achieve? Well, we'll see it in the Haggadah, right? So that's why it's more about the effect the story has on us than getting bogged down with the story itself. So when we are choosing to look at the story, we've got to look at it from the point of view, what does that teach me now? What aspects of it are we going to discuss tonight? And that's why it's a good idea to have themes, ideas at your Seder table that link back to the original story. So for instance, you know, the idea of what the poor women went through, okay? And how home life was terribly affected, okay? Well, think about it. I mean, you know, the reservists that have had to go, leave their homes, won't be home for Pesach this year. And those at home, and how are they coping? And it's not a story just for them, it's a story for now. You know? Those who were killed simply because they were Jewish, where Pharaoh threw the baby boys, which, by the way, we make an indirect reference to it in the Haggadah. But the effects of that are the same effects of when children were taken from their parents in the Holocaust and, you know, Hamas, you know, doing what they did on October the 7th. Right? We only wish it was confined to the past. It's not. So when we talk about Pharaoh, we're not just talking about Pharaoh. We're talking about Khomeini, and we're talking about Hitler, and we're talking about Haman. I mean, right? These have got to be real issues and how we engage with those issues. And that's what Seder night's all about, and what we hope will be a better future where we no longer live in a world that's like that. That's really the goal, okay? As we shall see. All right. So, we've taken this stuff in. Well, what would have happened had we not had the Exodus, God forbid, and we'd have been lost to history? And to engage with the messages we speak about, five rabbis who spend the whole night talking about the story that we've not yet addressed. So, that whole bit is from the bottom of page 9, line 14 in the Hebrew. Maaseh Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, is told that Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Joshua, Rabbi Elazar, son of Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon. And they spent the whole night telling the story of the coming out of Egypt, okay? And this idea that these different rabbis are engaging in their unique individual ways is a lovely introduction to the four sons. So if you look at, but the interesting thing about the four sons is the four sons is introduced with a paragraph on page 10, line 10. So you look at page 10, line 10. So before, we've just spoken about the five rabbis spending the whole night talking about the departure of Egypt and the importance of the departure of Egypt without looking at what they actually said, just that they did it. And then, before we introduce the four children, yes, let's be egalitarian. They're not just talking about boys, there's girls as well. You know, there are children, right? We say the following. Baruch HaMakom, blessed is God. Baruch Hu, blessed is He. Baruch Shana Santor Lama Yisrael, Baruch Hu. Blessed is he who gave the Torah to his people, Israel. Blessed is he. Keneged arba'o vonim dibra Torah. The Torah speaks about four children. Echad chacham, one is wise, ve'echad rasha, and one is wicked, ve'echad tam, and one who is, I always translate it as simple. It doesn't mean he's intellectually stupid. It means that his level of Jewish knowledge is very basic. So you have to start with first principles. And one doesn't even know how to ask a question. But before we get to that, notice we've got four Baruchs. Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shantorim Yisrael, Baruch Hu. Right? We've got four Baruchs. Beautiful idea. Each child is a different and specific blessing. And what it means is, don't assume that because child X, that works for them, it'll work for child Y. Yeah? You can never have children who grow up in the same house and turn out very, very differently. Okay? So the whole point of what's being said here, going back to the lady when I was in this school years ago, is you might have heard this year after year, but it's not supposed to be a static set script, the Haggadah. The Haggadah is a framework. And the point of that framework is to give you, if you like, pedagogical, educational principles as to how to make that evening work for everybody. So there's got to be something for the frummer, right? You know, we want something a bit more meaty and a bit more, you know, halachic maybe. Okay, that's why he's happy to know all about the laws of Paschal sacrifice, right? But you've also got to be ready for the one who sat there possibly looking at the watch saying, how much more of this? You know, what are you lot doing this for? This is archaic. Do you really think that? Right? You've got to be ready, you know. And what you're not supposed to say is, listen, if you don't like it, get lost. Right? You can be forceful, and that's where we are with the Rosha, and say, listen, going back to what we said before, had God not brought us out of Egypt, there'd be no Jewish people. But at least the ones who came out were the ones that when the moment of redemption happened, unlike the ones in the darkness. Remember we spoke about, Debbie, you asked me about the ones we lost in darkness. The ones lost in darkness, we compare them to the Russia. With an attitude like that, you'd have been lost. You're allowed to say that because it's germane to the subject. There's a big difference between insulting somebody and saying, well, if you think that, had you been there then, there'd have been no redemption for you. You've got to think about that, okay? The point is, there's got to be the Seder's got to be done in such a way where you're not just sticking to this script. That's very important, okay? You are enlarging upon the points that Haggadah's making to make everybody feel included. And that's the purpose of speaking about the rabbis at their level, and then speaking about, and therefore when we speak about the four sons, yes, we talk about our kids, but we actually talk about everybody around the table. Everybody, because there might be that person who's never been to a Seder before, or that you've got to make sure you don't leave them behind. You start with first principles. And even the people who are very familiar with it all should have the patience to recognise, I might know all this, but so-and-so at our Seder doesn't. And therefore, we've all got to go through this journey together with a conversation that's appropriate at all levels.
Can I just talk
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Since the Torah speaks of four sons, where?
Very good. So I was very tempted, actually. It's only because Mel, quite rightly, I can keep this for future. Haggadah, they are actually derived from context. What the Haggadah does do is quote there, and it shall be when your child asks you. So it's a shear in itself, which I'm going to give on a future occasion. But basically, we learn it from context. So there's a couple of places where it says there will be where your child asks you. And then there are other times it says, you shall tell. What's the difference? The you shall tell relates to a context where they didn't ask. Isn't it interesting that the reply, for very different reasons, to the Rasha and to the one who doesn't know how to ask a question is the same reply? Why? Because in both instances, they never asked a question. One, because I'm not interested in answering a question. I'm telling you how it is. Right? And the other, because they don't know how to ask a question. So, you're right. In the Torah, it doesn't say this one's called a chacham. The one that says, and it shall be where your child will ask you all about the details of Pesach, So, you know, that's the wise one, because they understand the importance of this. Then there's the other time it says, when your child will ask you and you give a much, and it gives a much more basic, for this is what God did for me. That's the TAM. But in both instances, they asked a question. In the other two, they didn't ask a question. And we learn it out from those verses, okay? Why it's done that way, I'll save for another time. But that's where we... So two of them are in the parasha of Bo, in the book of Exodus, and they're in Devarim, okay? Where, and you see from the verses where you're telling as opposed to... Because they didn't ask as opposed to responding to questions, etc. Fine. Okay, now. So after we've got the four sons, we're expecting to go into the story, but we don't. We then get a little excursion into, if you just look after the four sons, if you then look on page 11, from line 8, all of a sudden, having spoken about the four sons and the different approaches to the Exodus from Egypt, we've then got the penultimate paragraph in English. Long ago, our forefathers were worshippers of idols. Now, the Eternal is our God, and we worship him. Even as the Bible tells us, Joshua said to all the people, thus said the Eternal, our God, in the days of old, your forefathers lived beyond the river. That is Terach, the father of Abraham. So all of a sudden, we're going back to long before the Exodus and talking about our origins, that Abraham came from an idol worshipper. And there's a saying in Yiddish, Vos Epus, what's that got to do with the price of fish? Okay, I'm very tempted to tell you, but I'm doing this on purpose. On the Wednesday night, the 25th, I'm part of a Three Rabbis event, and I'm going to touch on this issue there. The only thing I want to emphasise at this point with our theme is, notice we're looking at Jewish history, not just from the Exodus and afterwards, but even before the Exodus. And the point it's making is that even before the challenges of Egypt, where we had the challenges of idolatry, we had the challenge of idolatry even before that. And therefore, as we the night of Seder night encapsulates all of Jewish history, both pre-Exodus and post-Exodus. Just like later on, we'll talk about Laban. And we say that Laban was even worse than Pharaoh, because had Laban killed Jacob, there'd have been, again, no future Jewish people. And they said, at least Pharaoh was allowing the girls to live, but not the boys. And again, what does that show us? We had people challenging our way of life even before the Egypt experience. And how did we deal with that? And of course, it reaches its, in terms of how numerous the Jewish people become, and we become a nation. The first time we're referred to as a nation is actually in Egypt by Pharaoh. Interesting how sadly it's the anti-Semites that always make out we're a much bigger number than we actually are. So they're everywhere. Okay, that's what Haman said. Yeah. So the basic answer at this stage, is that, again, it made this thesis. Seder night's not only about the coming out of Egypt, that's the centre story, but there's a pre-story and there's a post-story. And we'll see how that works shortly. But the part that I really want to sort of focus on is the bit where we do talk about Egypt. And the bit where we talk about Egypt is on page 12. Now, we don't need them because they're referred to in the text here, but Mel said, do we need Chumashim? Had we got the Chumashim, I'd have referred you to the parasha of Ki Tavo. Parasha Ki Tavo, let me give you the context. Parasha Ki Tavo is talking about when we finally settled in the land of Israel. We've come through the desert for 40 years. We've reached the promised land. We finally settled in the promised land. We finally built the holiest of all places where God's presence in its fullest in this world can dwell amongst the Jewish people, the Beit HaMikdash. And when you finally got the Beit HaMikdash and you finally bring in that first harvest of ripened produce, and we know that there are particular fruits and grains by which the land of Israel is particularly blessed. And the way that I always remember them, the fruits, remember the mnemonic Pogford. Pogford. What's Pogford? P-O-G-F-D. It's not a place like Ilford or Catford. Pogford. P is pomegranates. O is olives. G is grapes. F is figs. D is dates. Pogford, right? And you've got wheat and barley are the two grains. When the Jewish people brought from the first ripened produce of these fruits and grains, there was a tremendous ceremony where they brought their offering to the priest, who put it in a basket, and before the particular ritual over the Thanksgiving and the pilgrimage that they've done to bring their fruits, first fruits, to the temple, they have to make a declaration. Guess what that declaration is? It begins line 6 of page 12. Line 6 of page 12 in the English. Oh, that's an interesting translation. A Syrian sought to destroy my father. Okay, so this translator is getting more geographical than the word Arami. An Aramean literally means somebody who's a trickster. Right? Mirma means somebody devious. Because we know that Laban was very devious with Jacob. Kept changing the terms of his employment. We know, obviously, he tricked him when he gave Leah instead of Rachel. And then, however successful Jacob was when he was working for his father-in-law was always taking advantage and not giving him his due. And there comes the point where God said it's time to leave. And the Torah tells us that Laban was actually going to kill Jacob rather than let him leave, because he was his golden ticket. He was such an incredible rear of sheep and livestock and was creating tremendous wealth for Laban. Laban didn't want to let him go, and God says, you don't touch him. That's how we know that had God not interceded, Laban would have sought to destroy Jacob. And again, you could say, what's that got to do with the story? And it's showing the challenges that we had and the people out to destroy us even long before Egypt. Okay, and when we thought we'd said goodbye to the likes of Laban, we end up going down to Egypt after the story of Joseph and what happened there. And at first, again, everything seems fine. You know, Joseph is the viceroy, and we're in. And then, of course, the whole attitude changes at the beginning of Shemot, whether it was a new pharaoh or the same pharaoh that changed his attitude toward the Jews, and we become enslaved and treated terribly, and the infanticide and all the terrible things that happen. And this is really what this declaration is referring to. You could say, what's this potted history got to do with the fact that I'm now in Israel, thank God, and I'm bringing my first fruits, and I'm going to remember that Laban sought to destroy my father, and then we went down to Egypt, and you pick up the Egypt story from verse 8, line 8, yeah? Vayered Mitzrayim, he went down to Egypt. So what the rabbis now do, you're only actually dealing, I know it feels very, there's only four verses being dealt with here on the night of Seder, only four. And the rabbis basically delineate every little phrase. He went down to Egypt. Why? Why? Because compelled by God's decree. If you remember, when the family was in Egypt, Jacob was reluctant to go down because he knew he had the prophecy that Egypt's the place where we're going to have a very dark period of Jewish history. And do I want to initiate that by the whole family being there? And before he goes down, God reassures him, I will be with you, but this is your destiny, you've got to go down to Egypt. Okay? And we get the whole thing there, and a few in number, and there he became a nation, etc. Right? But my question is, this is all, even from the point of view of the Torah, a retrospective. It's not the book of Shemot. It's not Moses being told at the burning bush, the Jewish people are suffering, you will go in and say to Pharaoh, let my people go. And then the whole thing about the snake, the rod turning to a snake, and, you know, blood's going to come, and etc. Right? It's none of that. It's actually a retrospective, not in the context of the Torah going in order, the book of Bereshit, then Shemot, but actually looking back from the point of view that we're in the land of Israel and we've got our temple and we're looking back at it then. That's the context of these verses. Why use these verses? Surely go to the book of Exodus that tells it in sequence and in order. No, here we're referring to certain parts of the story. You know, what we went through, how terrible it was, and the context of we're now bringing our first fruits. Okay? So, I'm aware of the time, and I always try and finish, if not on time, as close to time as possible, right? Just one more thing to throw into the mix, and we will see that the answer to all of these questions comes in Dayenu. Dayenu gives you the answer, and the answer to the original question, how many steps should there be to your Seder? Okay? But I just want to, before we look at briefly at Dayenu and bring all these elements together and explain why is the matzah sometimes covered and then it's not covered, right? See, I haven't forgotten. Any other questions I threw out?
Comments.
So again?
And last Wednesday, and you still haven't
asked.
Well, that one, sorry.
Why we can't have hummus.
Okay, okay. Yeah, very good. Yeah, all relevant. Okay. Now, when it comes to the plagues, do we actually discuss the plagues? No. All we do is give them as a headline. So if you look at page 16, and we know, of course, we spill a little bit of wine. We go, damn, so we list them, damn, svadeya, kinim, arom. This always reminds me a bit like a movie trailer. So imagine you've never seen the Ten Commandments, the Cecil B. DeMille, and there's been updated versions since then. So there'll be plagues, there'll be blood, there'll be frogs. Without going into, well, what actually happened when the, you know, who did it affect and how widespread was it, and, you know. Well, the frogs that emerged, and we're told, the Medrash says that there was one big frog that went rabbit, and it then released all the little frogs. And again, such a powerful, you know, there's a famous rabbinic explanation of that about anti-Semitism, whereby you've got the little frogs, i.e. those who maybe have a bit of anti-Semitism, but the climate isn't right to show it, right? It only takes that Palestinian action, and all of a sudden they're all there, because somebody with a big voice said, come on everybody, let's do it. Or we spoke about things being timeless in every generation. But the point is, the plagues, we don't really speak about them very much at all. And we mention what they are. What we do have is the rabbis saying, now, if there were 10 plagues in Egypt, right, then there must have been 5 times more at the parting of the sea. Why do you get that from? Because the Egyptians referred to the plagues in Egypt as the finger of God. Remember that bit? So we got a finger in Egypt, and that was 10. But at the parting of the sea, we're told they saw the hand of God. Oh, it's 5 times more. You get a bit of that. And then we come to Dayenu. Right? And in the remaining 15 minutes or so, I'm going to explain Dayenu, how it explains everything we've spoken about so far. So here we go. Dayenu, we have twice. Have you ever noticed that, on saying that? I've got it twice, without the Dayenu, but the second time, why? Let me show you. Because if you look at page 19, I'll quickly do it in the English. Page 19, we're told, how thankful must we be to God, the all-present, for all the good he did for us. Okay? Now, remind me, this is key, if I don't do this, we've got to come back to the first line of this in Hebrew, because it's crucial to explain everything I've said so far. But basically, we're thanking God for what he did. So what's the first line? Had he brought, you know, Elu, Elu, Hotzi, and we all know it. We're not going to sing Song of Diana because we won't get finished in time. So what's the first thing he brought us out of Egypt? And then he executed judgment against Egypt. And then if you want, have a little sing song, Die, Diana. There we go, right? Number 3, he executed judgment. You always get a repetition of the one he's just done. It's what we call a Kalvachoma. Not only did he do this, but he even went further and did that, okay? So can you see just what you've got? Brought us out of Egypt, executed judgment against them, did justice to their idols. Just turn over the page, page 20, halfway down in English. Can you see it says, how much more so do we have to be thankful for the manifold and unbounded blessings of the all-present God? And guess what it lists? The things that we've just said in Dayenu. All the things that we've just said in Dayenu, you get them again. What did he do? So we're now on page 20 at the bottom paragraph. Brought us out of Egypt. Elu, Elu, Hotzi. It's what we've just done. Right? Executed judgment against them. Did justice to their idols. Slew their firstborn. Gave us their property. Divided the sea for us. Yeah? That's all what we've just... The only difference is you don't go die, die, anu in between. Why do we need it all again? I've just been told it. Okay? Right. I'm going to bring all this together now. Da, 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 in the next 10 minutes. Probably more, 15 minutes. Okay? Right. Here's the thing. Let's go back to our order of the Seder at the beginning, okay? Which is on page 4. I'm now going to reveal to you how many steps there should be in the Seder. Where did they make a mistake? The mistake is on number 7. Look at number 7. Yeah. It makes out as if motzi and matzah are one step. They're not, they're two. Any sudder, any meal on Yom Tov, you've got to make a motzi. It just happens on Pesach. The only type of motzi you can have is matzah. So you've got to have... Dorian's put non-chomets anyway, okay? But there is a separate mitzvah to have matzah in its own right, separate from the fact that it's the only type of bread you can use anyway. How do we know this? Because you make a separate bracha on it. You don't just say hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. You say al achilas matzah as well. There are two separate mitzvahs. Motzi is one step. Matzah is another step. Therefore, how many steps should there be? 15. 15. Bear that in mind, very important. 15 steps. Okay? You probably guessed where this is going. When you look at Diana, it's easy when you look at the page 20 without Diana. Guess how many of those things we are thanking God for. I'll make it easy for you. 15. You can count them if you don't believe me, right? 15. Now, those 15, do you remember what I said about all of Jewish history? If it's only about the Exodus from Egypt, if that was the goal, just to talk about the Exodus as opposed to being a means to achieve the goal, then if you notice, the last five are post-Exodus. So if you look at the bottom of page 20, having come out of Egypt, we've got God gave us Shabbat. Well, of course, that's once we've left Egypt, we're in Mount Sinai. Although it is true that God had mentioned certain laws about Shabbat before them. But even then, they were after we came out of Egypt. Look over the page. Brought us to Mount Sinai. That's after Egypt. Gave us the Torah. That's after Egypt. Brought us to the land of Israel. That's after Egypt. And built for us the Holy Temple. That's the 15th one. So we've gone way past the Exodus and the going through the desert. But we've settled in the land of Israel. We're thanking God for. We've got the land of Israel. We've got the Holy Temple. And because we finished on a high, if you like, I heard a lovely phrase. What we need to do on the Seder night is to remember a nostalgic past and an unrealised future. It's good, isn't it? A nostalgic past, because once upon a time we were all in the land of Israel. And once upon a time we did have the temple. And at the heart of our prayers is this, we want to please God get back to that reality. So Seder works on two levels. There's the reality of now, and the reality of now is there is too much persecution in the world, and we're not free in our land, in the land of Israel as well. We know, look at what's going on. And we don't have the Beit HaMikdash, and we're not able to live in the land of Israel the way we want to, because the Jews who left Egypt weren't thinking, great, we're going to go to a land where the Gazans are going to kill us. Great, we're going to go to a land where Hezbollah... And that's not what they were looking forward to. And again, as I said last time, I'm a religious Zionist. I see the importance of Medinat Yisrael. But even religious Zionists pray for the day where the fulfillment of the redemption is not only we have the land of Israel and we have Tzahal and we have all our institutions and what have you, but we live in the kind of peace and we can serve God fully. Every time you uncover the matzah, you're going back to the story of the past and the story of now. So the story of the past is when we're talking about the coming out, because we call it Lechem Oni. Now, Lechem Oni is normally translated bread of poverty. You know what it also means? Bread over which you give answers, says the Gemara. Because the root, Ayin Nun Yod, is Latin, it means to answer. So every time we are talking about the story and giving answers as to why the story makes sense, we uncover the matzah. That's when we are dealing with the past and the now. Because the only full observance of matzah that we can fulfill at the Seder is the bread of affliction. Why? Because we're still living in a world of affliction. And we're still living in a world where we're not all in the land of Israel and we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. Right? That's the only full. The symbolic aspect of matzah is when it accompanied the Paschal sacrifice. Which we can't... What do we use instead? A fliggle. Right? Since when is that lamb? Because we've got to use something instead of, because it's not the real thing. Okay? What's your afikoman, which was supposed... Right? Matzah. Symbolic of the future. Okay? So the only full observance of the matzah is the matzah over which we're answering questions about the past, and the bread of affliction, the bread of poverty, the bread that represents things that we don't yet have. But when we pick up the wine and we cover the matzah, that's where we are talking about the future, the cup of redemption, the cup of Elijah, the yet unrealized future, that we're not yet there yet, but we have faith it will happen in the same way that God brought us in the past out of Egypt. Every time we bring it back to the now, what do? And the future, we cover the matzah. For he, Shamda, this is stood by, now we're talking about the now. And when then we pick up for the second cup of wine, we make a bracha about the future, when in the future God will bring us back to our land. So the wine represents celebration and future, and the matzah represents the past and affliction. Apart from when we think of it in a symbolic way, of what we, when it will accompany the Paschal sacrifice. Now, therefore, you see lots of references to temple practices because we pray for the day where they will be returned. Do you know when you sing about that? Kel b'nei, b'nei b'etcha b'kar. That's after the meal. We're in full future mode. The whole idea is to say God redeemed us then. That was that phase of redemption. And now we've got to look forward to the future redemption. And the ultimate expression of joy in the temple was Sukkos. Because Sukkos represented the conclusion of the three pilgrim festivals. You'd had the barley harvest at Pesach, the wheat harvest at Shavuos, and the final, most plentiful ingathering, the final, at the beginning of the year on Sukkos, which was seen as the conclusion of the journey that began when we came out of Egypt, got the Torah, and then the celebrations in the temple on Sukkos were so intense and joyous that the rabbi said, whoever had not experienced that level of joy, what we call the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, which, by the way, is also called the Beis HaBechira, the chosen house, which is how we refer to it in Dayenu, right? The chosen, that was the ultimate. Now, guess what the ultimate expression of joy in the temple involved? The Levites, starting on the first of 15 steps and going up each step during Sukkot, and each of the things they sang began Shir HaMa'alot. Do you ever wonder why it says a song of degrees, a song of steps? So there's 15 steps that we have to undertake on Pesach. The journey from how we first came out of slavery to serve God fully in the temple on Sukkos. Okay? And we went through a journey. What was the journey? First of all, oppression. Then transition. And then chosenness. What's the symbol of oppression? Maror. So the first five of Dayenu are all to do with Egypt and the oppression. We're in Egypt, God executed judgment against Egyptians, did justice to their idols, slew the firstborn. And even though we, the slaying of the firstborn meant our freedom, what do? When we mention the slaying of the firstborn, we spill the wine because we were saddened that it took pain for that to happen. And when we left Egypt, we were at least able to come out with the valuables that the Egyptians gave us before those the first five, Maror. The next five were all about the journey. So that's when God divided the sea and we came through dry shod and drowned our oppressors and the journey 40 years in the desert. Mount of the manna, what represents the journey? Matzah, because that was the food that we had for the journey in transition. And the final five are the chosenness of our represented God. Who did God give Shabbos to? Us. Who did God meet at Mount Sinai? Us. Who did he give the Torah to? Us. Who did he give the land of Israel to? Us. The Holy Temple? Us. Because we've ended on a high, talking about the chosenness, that's why, says Rabbi Kamli, it goes straight into talking about the Pesach, because the Paschal sacrifice is symbolic of our unique relationship with our God, who the first mitzvah he gave to us in Egypt was to show your commitment to me by bringing the Paschal sacrifice. That's why it reverses the order. Because we've just gone Maror, Matzah, Pesach, we're on a high. So now we're looking forward to the time where we can bring the Paschal sacrifice in the future. And because it's not now, we're not able to do it. So you know what? When you mention this, but you don't point at the shank bone. You don't point at it because it represents that which we can't do. Then bringing back down to where we are, Matzah. But this Matzah we can fulfill as a mitzvah on its own terms, not as part of the Paschal sacrifice and not as kind of the on the journey to the land of Israel, but purely. Because, why can't we have chametz? Because chametz represents that unrealized future. That unrealized future. The matzah is lowly. The matzah is flat. The matzah is not yet risen. So the chametz, that fits in very nice with the idea of it being the bread of a simple bread of poverty. And therefore, we had to leave quickly. We didn't leave with loads of, you know, hadn't been to Hadar or wherever you do your kosher shopping. We had to leave quickly and ready for redemption, the redemption that's yet to happen, okay? And that's why, having gone in the order of Maror, matzah Pesach, because we're on that high, we then do them back in the reverse order, Pesach matzah, because once we've had the maror, we're then back to the reality of in every generation, we want that future. Because what is that future all about? And then I'll come back to you, Dorian, I just want to finish what I want to say. What is that future? That future is a future where there is no longer persecution, when we can freely be in our land, living according to God's word, with our temple, and the redemption for the future. It's all about preparing us for the future, is Seder night. That's what it's all about, okay? And that's why Pesach, Matzah, Maror comes immediately on the heels of Dayenu. And why do we have it twice? The first time, we are simply thanking God for each step. Each step of the redemption, we're saying thank you. It's enough for us. It's not enough for us to say, oh, the redemption was complete. It's no good God leaving us in the wilderness, then, well, now what do we do? We're not saying it would have been enough just to leave us in the wilderness. We're saying, we are grateful that the redemption, each step is worthy of us to say thank you. And then the second time, we see how each step led to the next step. So you thank you God the first time for each thing he did, and then how it fitted into a whole process of redemption. The sum is bigger than its parts. So not only have you got to be grateful for each step, but how each step led to the next step and brought us to our, not only out of Egypt, but to our land and to our ultimate service of God, the 15 steps. Guess when Pesach falls? The 15th of Nisan. And guess when Sukkot falls? The 15th of Tishri, when the moon is full. So the whole number, and just one final thing, obviously 15 is 3-5. You've just noticed three steps of redemption. The first five relating to Maror, Egypt, then the transition, which is Matzah, and then chosenness, which is Pesach. 3-5s, but we're told that there are 3-5s that are hidden from us on Seder now. What are the 3-5s? If you look in the Mishnah, you won't find the questions as we have them as a fifth question. Yeah. What's the fifth question? The fifth question is, the youngster says, on all of the nights, we could have meat that is boiled or stewed, but tonight we've got to have it roasted. Why? Because at the time that question was asked, we had the temple. In the time of the temple, you must have roasted lamb as per the Paschal sacrifice. Once we no longer had that, that question was taken away. Lord Sacks wrote this beautiful essay about the real number of Seder is 5, not 4. There's the fifth question that we can't ask because we don't have the temple. There's the fifth son, the person that's not even at Seder. There's the fifth cup, the one that we pour but we don't drink. I spoke about it at the lunch. All to do with those missing elements that we need for the future. When we have our Seder meal, it's lovely and everything else, but we're realising we've only got one side of the Seder at the moment. The whole second part is all about the unrealised future that we yearn for and pretend as if it's happening now, because our faith in it will bring it to be. Okay, so I hope I've covered all the questions, why there are 15 steps, why we go 15 steps, why Diana answers this, all of that, and the idea being that every time you cover the matzah, you're dealing with the now and the future, and every time you uncover the matzah, you're going back into a journey over the significance of the Pesach story, the original story, but then we need to move beyond that story once we get to the meal, which is why, what's the last thing you do at the end of the meal? You have the Afikoman, which is that bigger piece which represents the future redemption which we yet to experience. Any questions, comments?
Did you answer the four questions you said?
So the four questions really are a prompt to get it. So the answer is that no, the matzah question comes much later, that it'll be asleep by then. And even though that's more only about the matzah rather than not having the chometz, okay? One idea is the one I shared with you, that the chometz, because the truth of the matter is that normally, as we know, chometz plays a very big part in our lives, okay? But that's when we can, Shabbos, you can fulfill with your challahs and your chometz. But Pesach is representing that hasn't yet risen yet, that we haven't yet got to that point.
Yeah. And the actual four questions.
Right, yeah. So the answer is no, they're not. They're deliberately left unanswered. And why are they left unanswered? Because it's for us to bring our thought, just like the rabbis, have got all these different perspectives. And that's why, when we chose, so what was the whole idea of choosing that section from Parashat Ki Tavar? The whole point is talking about the Seder in retrospective from the point of view of those who've come to see all of that realised. That's the point, okay? So the idea that you're looking back, and therefore what's the whole idea of telling this story? This is the beginnings of our story, when we were originally, Abraham's father was an idol. Look how far we've come, basically. Right? We started humbly, or, you know, the Leeds story would be the Jews were in Chapel Town and they moved to the, or the East End in London. And right? We've always, but the point is we're on a journey to a destination. It's not just we're, you know, yes, we talk about that we're a constant moving nomadic people, but we're not just on a journey for the sake of being on a journey. We're supposed to be on a journey to a destination, okay? We mustn't forget where we came from. And we're making that contrast between how things were and how things are, and how things we would like them to be. And I mentioned, I think, at the lunch, that the whole idea of leaning actually relates to the Roman period, because their vision of what freedom meant then were those on a chaise longue being looked after as the aristocracy. Okay, so it's the concept of freedom. We don't really relate to freedom in that way today. That's how the rabbis then did, and they were the ones that formulated the Haggadah. Okay, likewise, the two dips. I mentioned the one about Joseph and the carapace, but the final dipping was just before redemption happened, when we smeared the blood from the Paschal sacrifice. So two questions are about slavery, right? Bread of affliction, matzah and marrow. Two questions are about freedom, when that final dipping was before we were free, and the reclining represents freedom. How do we go from one to the other? It's a journey that we've got to discuss together from all the principles of what the Haggadah lays down. So sometimes, you're right, not all the answers are there. It's for us, through our customs, through our unique, to discuss things. Not everything is actually supposed to be all revealed in the Haggadah. That's the point. So the missing bits of the story are for us to fill in. That's the point. It's pretty specifically designed to be that way. Right? So if you want to bring about Moses in the burning bush and let my people go, you will not find the words "let my people go" anywhere in the Haggadah. There's only one passing reference to Moses. It's when the Jewish people believed in Moses, in God and in Moses' servant. But Moses plays very little part. You know why? Because actually, it's about our relationship with God. Moses was the facilitator of that relationship. But on the night of Seder night, it is about opening ourselves up to our relationship with God, the greatness of God, and our collective story as the Jewish people. And we have to fill in the gaps that aren't there. Anything else that I may have missed? Or Suzanne, yes?
In the meat, yes. The opposite that you were supposed to have. Not have roast.
Yeah. Correct. That's exactly the point. So that's why that question's not in there. That fifth question is the one that was taken out precisely for that reason. We used to have it in there. When in the days of the temple, the youngest would ask the question, "Tonight, why have we got to have roasted meat?" Once the temple was destroyed, that fifth question got taken out. And as a result of us recognising that our Seder is incomplete, that's why you don't have roast meat. That's exactly the point. Or if you are going to have roast meat, even if it's not lamb, you're supposed to have a bit of liquid with it. Yeah. And don't have it dry roast. That's too reminiscent of the Paschal sacrifice that we can't have. So you can have meat with pleasure, but make sure there's a nice little juice in it. And, not dry roasted, because that's too similar. And that's why the Ashkenazi, it's not even used lamb at all. Chicken neck or whatever. Right? Since when's a lamb a chicken? That's why, because it's a substitute. We can't have lamb unless... I remember... when I was in Reading many years ago, it turns out it was one of these messianic, this guy came to shul and he had nowhere for Seder, and he was davening away, and his kids, one was called, all very biblical names, Elijah, Jeremiah, like that, right? Uh-oh. And all of a sudden, he sat at our set and he goes, where's your lamb? And what he meant by that was, he thought there was going to be like on Rosh Hashanah, the sheep's head kind of thing, right? He thought there was going to be I don't know what he thought, right? He says, "Where's your?" And all of a sudden he says, "Well, at my temple in America, da 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 da, we make sure there's a proper lamb on the table." I thought, "Oy vey's me," right? And it turns out it was one of these messianic Yoshki kind of, and they thought we've got to have lamb because of the Paschal sacrifice. And I explained, because we don't have our temple. He went, "Well, right, you don't do it properly." I went, "No." So there you go. So you're quite right, Susan. We don't have the lamb. We call it a shack. I mean, some people do go out of the way to have a shack bone, but but we don't eat it, and we don't point to it. Whereas with the Pesach matzah, you do point. You either lift up the matzah or you lift up, but you don't. Not the Paschal, because that we can't fulfil. So therefore, we have a distance from it. Any other questions, comments, Doreen?
I just learned some lovely teaching a few years ago about chametz.
Yes.
One of the reasons we don't have it is because it's puffed up, and it's to make sure, like you were saying, that Max is flat, that we're not big-headed about what we've achieved already, that we should
beautiful. Well, there's a lovely, you see it in the word, you probably know this one. Oh, well, I'll come to give rocks in a minute. Yeah, yeah, very good. Yeah, well, there are those who... So the concept, the other concept of chametz is that, of course, anything that's risen, it's the air that makes it look bigger than it actually is. The actual substance is not as big as it looks because it's risen, it's full of hotter. So if you look at the word chametz, you'll see the only difference between matzah and chametz, chametz has got a chet. Both words have got mem tzadi, right? But a chet is enclosed, and that represents the person's ego. There's no world beyond me. I am everything, right? It's all about me, right? But the hay of matzah's got the gap. Where we